I'm now realizing, you know, all the hundreds of stories I've read about bands and interviews, the stuff that they say that's like, ah, yeah, you say this, and when you go on the road and you meet people and this collaboration happened, and yeah, it's another story about another album that got made. And now I'm realizing that does happen. You know, you're just, when you're meeting people or you're on the dance floor with people, as I am for constantly 2 weeks, you're on the dance floor, or on behind the booth or whatever, you're just meeting people and things happen, you know, projects and friends. And yeah, it's pretty magical.
Welcome back to another episode of First Pressing, the show where we showcase local record labels and label heads. Today, we're hitting the dance floor with Ewan Jensen of Red Embo Records.
Yeah, I sent out a lot of demos. You don't get replies or whatever. And I was like, let's just do this, you know, thing ourselves. Most of the records were all sold in Australia. And then 10 years later, they're all over the world. I sort of just went on this big sort of spree of releasing other people's music. You know, some people get tired or run out of inspiration, but who doesn't want to keep on at least trying to just make new music and see what people, that risk of putting it out into the world is addictive.
Located in Perth, Red Ember was created by Ewan in the late 90s along with producer and confidant Justin Zerbst. Their first 00 EP featuring both producers was officially launched via a live PA at Crush nightclub in Northbridge. Since then, their imprints have gone on to seek out true underground deep house and electronic producers in the shadows to help facilitate a wider recognition of their music. You're listening to Season 1 of First Pressing. Tell me about yourself and all the creative things you've done.
Yeah, yes, I know. There's a long time, so dates and places starting to get fuzzy.
Well, how far can we go back? Like, when did you start music?
Making music, or sort of getting into music?
Yeah, let's go from early, getting into music.
I reckon there's definitely a good point that I do know the date of, because I have a magazine that backs that up, and that was the first issue of Future Music magazine that I bought. So that's going to be 93, 92, and that had a free copy of something called Octomed, which is now an infamous tracker.
Yeah.
Music tracker for the Amiga 500, and that's pretty much where I diverted from playing games to making music.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So tech was always kind of, you were loving games and then music came along.
Yep. I started making music on a computer without a keyboard, just, you know, programming. I say that tentatively.
Yeah.
It's not intensive programming, but yeah, making music sort of, not with an instrument, you know?
Nice. And where are you now in this world? Tell us about the label and everything you do.
Well, yeah, right now I run a label, I guess a couple of labels, one that's got a few imprints, to make it look larger than life. I run a label called Red Ember Records. It's got three different imprints, one which supports newbies to vinyl. So that's my supporting people that were like me ages ago that were with the label. Yeah, it's got three imprints. I've got another label. I play live music now. I'm a producer myself. Yeah, so there's sort of a lot of music stuff surrounding the label itself, which is just, you know, an avenue to release music when other people don't want to.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
So what was your first live kind of performance?
Yeah, my very first live performance there's sort of like an A and B period. The A period was like, maybe I should say Z and A, because the first period I was like, people just said, you need to play live. If you make electronic music and you've got this label that you've just released a record on, it was the very first release on Red Ember. And, you know, it was said, you have to do a launch. That's what you do. So you got to do it. And so I put together a live set that was it was a janky sort of live set. I don't even know how I got through it alive. My friend Justin Zerbst, who was on the other side of the record of the label, he played an amazing set. And so that was like 1997. And so that was the official launch of the label and my first live gig. We did a couple more live gigs, and then I decided that that was just a pretty scary a pretty scary kind of outfit. I didn't really know how to sort of play live. I didn't have the equipment to do it, so it was sort of a guy with a computer sequencing at home, sort of thrust upon stage.
Yeah.
In a atmosphere that at that point I still thought was like, you know, for bands.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I didn't, the whole live rave act thing, which I think is totally, totally cool. I didn't really know how any of that worked.
Yeah. What was the scene like?
I guess surrounding that event, that was at Crush, which is now called Geisha.
Right.
That was a big club at that point. There was a couple of, there was a record store, Purveyor Complex Records, pumping out great records. So it was Central Station and Dada's and a whole bunch of, places. The Greenwich underneath the, His Majesty's Theatre was a raging, deep house sort of scene, hugely popular, sort of pulling in lots of people, some from the fringes, heaps of DJs. Heaps of people just buying vinyl because they just loved the music.
Yeah, cool.
It was pretty big. And that was sort of the period where I released the first couple of records was the start of when the big festivals, the sort of the onset of the festival, the electronic festival thing happened.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. So you did live for a bit, kind of stepped away from it, but you now do it again?
Yeah, it took me that long. I mean, I don't know. I think I did a couple of gigs. One very bad review in street press, which I deserved. But I think that scarred me. Like that just sealed the public embarrassment. It wasn't that bad, but it was just I was just absolutely not prepared for it. I think a lot of people took their entire back in those days would take their studio out onto stage, meaning the computer and everything, and, somehow put together a live set. And I sort of did, didn't get that quite right. So it's taken me this long to sort of realize what I want to do is just have a completely miniaturized version of what I've got in the studio. And of course, all the synthesizers and keyboards and stuff now, the old ones that I've got, you've got these little mini versions you can chuck in your backpack. So it all kind of made sense. It wasn't a total freak out, but I still had to get over the nerves thing performing in front of people, which was a crazy jump off the cliff kind of moment for me. And then I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is cool. So
yeah, cool.
Yeah, it's you can hide in your studio and make music I can forever. And it really was a moment where it's like, you've just got to do this and just push yourself over. And I'm, 11 shows in now or something, and I'm actually starting to enjoy it.
Cool. That's interesting, isn't it? What pushed you to finally be like, all right, I've got to get this done?
I gotta say, a huge amount of, I mean, people have always sort of asked or sort of pushed me along. There's always that whole thing similar to, like, if you tell someone, oh, I might make electronic music, if they ask me, I don't, that's not my icebreaker. And the very next thing is, oh, so you're a DJ, right? And the other thing is, oh, you make electronic music. Why aren't you performing? Not as closely aligned, but there's just people were surprised that it's like, oh, you're like scared to do that or whatever. And yeah, there was a lot of that. And I 5 years ago made a lot of friends in Europe because of the sort of resurgence of the label's old releases. And a lot of these people were just like, you got to come. And part of meeting some of these people, some of which I've known for longer than 5 years, for like 20 years overseas, I just wanted to go and hug them and hang out with them. And it was kind of a means to an end.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and an excuse to go on a holiday. And the idea of a solo person for me going on holiday with a mission is so much more attractive than me sort of wandering around galleries or figuring out what to do in, you know, Paris for a week. As much as that's kind of lame, the whole, okay, you've got 5 clubs to play in 2 weeks in Europe, and you're also getting these kind of little hours off to do stuff, plus instant bunch of friends to hug every time you land somewhere. It's it's very nice.
I do totally understand that. I feel like when I go away, it's like to go to a music conference.
Yeah. Exactly. I love it. And there's just so much. I'm now realizing, you know, all the hundreds of stories I've read about bands and interviews, the stuff that they say that's like, you say this, and when you go on the road and you meet people and this collaboration happened, and yeah, it's another story about another album that got made. And now I'm realizing that does happen. You just, when you're meeting people or you're on the dance floor with people, as I am for constantly 2 weeks, you're on the dance floor, or on behind the booth or whatever, you're just meeting people and things happen, you know, projects and friends. And yeah, it's pretty magical. I'm living through, I guess, maybe what people should have done on my gap year or whatever, like normal people do. I'm doing it like 20 years late.
That's all right. You can never be too late in music, right? So let's focus on the label a bit. When did Red Ember Records start, and how did it start?
Yeah, so it would be like 1997 was the first EP. And it was like 20 units. And really the reason why it happened was myself, a friend of mine, Justin Zerbst, who, you know, was a close friend of mine. We used to hang out, sort of share everything musically, and also to, you know, I guess, shared the space on the label for the first, whatever it was, 9 releases. You know, we've, from different angles, fell in love with house music. You know, wanted to get on a label, were making music, you know, sort of just going through the early stages of that. And yeah, I sent out a lot of demos. He did as well. You don't get replies or whatever. And I was like, let's just do this, you know, thing ourselves. And we just wanted to make the record sort of just so that we could sit in the lounge room and look at ourselves on a record or listen to it. Really, it was just about that. It was like, this is like a real world process. This is sort of like this is just how music works. It's like, you know, we've got music collections, and so we want our own music on something that would become part of our own collection, and of course sell a few to cover the costs locally. But yeah, we got them made by a guy called Peter King in New Zealand, who was, I'm not sure if he's still about, but he was making lathe cut records.
Right.
So they were polyplastic, and these things, to a vinyl aficionado in Perth, of which there were many, still are, you know, getting the top quality sort of Detroit fat pressed kind of 180 gram records, house music, these things sound like Fisher Price records. So there was a barrier for some people, but a lot of people got it. They were like, you're doing it whatever way you can. It sounds kind of crummy, but it's like, cool. This is, you know, underground. This is like just doing whatever you can to go through the process. So,
yeah. And you got 20, did you say?
Yeah. I think it was the first one was like 20. Yeah. And it sort of, you know, built up from there. The second one, you know, it was like 40, 60, you know, a lot of the first, I think 9 releases, something like that, were like in 20s, 40s. 60, something like that, but no higher than that. And then sort of after doing probably way too many in that format, we then moved to Corduroy Records in Melbourne, who would do a minimum pressing of 100 records, which was like, oof, that's a massive, you know.
Yeah, that's a lot more to sell.
That was a big, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was self-distributing it. So, we're talking mailing records to all the record stores around Australia from, trying to think of the furthest ones, probably like across the whole country upwards would be like Rocking Horse Records, I think it was called in Brisbane, you know, central stations everywhere. Yeah, doing records by mail order on consignment. Nightmare. But yeah, so I did that, and that was at that point, then it was like, no, I can't do this anymore, and started looking, you know, further afield, and managed to get the next you know, what's that? We had a handful of polyplastic records, then a couple of vinyl records, and then the next one, which was a compilation, was done in Watts in America. So it was like, finally got sort of proper distribution and a proper, right, proper amount. But yeah, those early records were just, I don't know, it's just like cottage industry stuff, just, you know, ripping a picture out of a magazine and like, cool, that can be the label, and typing out, you know, the label type, and having this guy in New Zealand make these records. The roof on his house was made of the same material. I don't know how that worked, but yeah, it was, you know, but it was fun. So, and like I said, people that sort of appreciated, you know, the sort of the nounce of just doing it a little bit outside of the normal lines and just doing it small, we're like, yep, I get it. You know, it's fun, it's crunchy, it's dirty, whatever. You know, this is just the start of things. And DJ, you know, some DJs even played them out occasionally, which used to freak me out if anyone... Well, there's a couple of times some people sort of like waving the record to me sort of churlishly across the other side of the room. It's like, don't put it on, don't put it on. Because these things just would skip. The needle would skip off them like at a moment's notice. So
1997, this is big CD era, right? There's not many people, I guess, in dance music, you did records because everyone was DJing vinyl. This is before...
Yeah, CDJs? I don't even know if that maybe CDJs might have just started or something, but I maybe only just. They were probably around, maybe. I can't even remember. But, like, yeah, in, you know, my scene, or the scene that I was lucky enough to find, the house music scene, like, yeah, I just don't remember anyone playing anything other than vinyl. So,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, it was kind of like you know, that was the only thing to do. You get like a CD was like, oh, if you make an album and maybe you can do it on CD. There was a couple of other producers that made CD EPs and stuff. But yeah, vinyl, DJs, four DJs by electronic musicians. It was just like that. That was it.
Yeah. Who was involved in the label? Was it just you on your own?
Yeah, well, I mean, I basically ran the label and sort of did all the stuff, but my friend Justin, you know, was like, he was the guy that we just used to hang out all the time, and it's like, I have no idea. Yeah, and, you know, talking about and going through everything and living through everything. So, you know, the label was there, you know, for both of us to put our music out, so which is why it was like, it was always... Okay, we're doing a split EP. You're on one half. I'm on one half. Okay, let's do solo EPs. Well, you do the next one, and then I'll do the one after that. You know, it was always sort of, yeah, it was there for us both. You know, I was definitely the guy that did the, you know, the business side of things. And when I say business side of things, it's like, you know, at that point, it's just, you know, licking stamps and, you know, and sending faxes, if I can say that. You know, through that sort of early steps of just, you know, like doing records on consignment for a whole country. It's like, you know, it's not big stuff, but it's like going through the process of finding two or three record, you know, stores per state and having a relationship with them and, you know, posting them and then, you know, telling them, hey, I'm going to send one to the local radio station. So, you know, it's cool. We're sort of doing something to support the record, but I'm too scared to tour.
Yeah, right. So, consignment is like you would have to sell them in those stores to get money?
Yeah. So, you'd send the record, you know, in a box. And again, this is like these people were like, you know, very generous to sort of like pick up the phone from a random person saying, hey, I'm from Perth and I make kind of deep house music and stuff. Can you sell my record? Heaps of, you know, they're all into it, but it's like, yeah, you know, send me the three records and, you know, we'll pay you when we sell them.
Right.
And of course, if they don't sell them, then they're like, ah, I want to send the records back now. And you're like, oh, so that's another $20 postage, and I'd often just, I mean, again, it's no biggie. Like, it was just a process of the thing, but like, you know, then you just end up saying, ah, well, just keep them, you know? And so, you know, and again, today I would do the same thing. I've done the same thing. I've actually, you know, I've had a couple of boxes of records crushed recently, which was probably the most painful version of that. But, you know, at least the record store will eventually, it'll get into some people's hands.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, it did, because those first, whatever it was, 9 releases, I did post some overseas to some, you know, what I consider, you know, house legends and stuff to try and get on their label, you know, send them a big pack, you know, I'm doing this stuff and there's also music I want to put on your label kind of thing. But most of the records were all sold in Australia. And then 10 years later, they're all over the world.
Yeah, right.
You know, like literally all over the world. People are on Discogs going, I found this in a box in New York and, you know, whatever. They just went everywhere. It was weird. Whoever bought them here, you know, yeah, it was pretty, pretty magic. That did take 10 years though.
Yeah, cool. So where is the label now?
The label sort of went to sleep, I don't know, like 2000 or something like that. And then I just burnt out with it.
Yeah.
And I was also, you know, sort of managed to, very lucky to get on some other labels like in America and stuff that I, absolutely coveted. So it's like, oh wow. Like, apart from everything else, it's like, sweet, this person can do all that work that I hate.
That you don't want to do anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like when you're making music and stuff, it's just like, eh, it's not music. So I would prefer to make music. That's why I love releasing on other people's records, because I just get to be that, that fool that's like, oh, this is so cool. Cool and stuff, and yeah, and you know, they're the ones that have to do all that hard work, yeah, and all the promo and stuff.
But you know what goes into that now, so your appreciation level is
totally. So it just, I love it. So that's like, for me, there's a massive imbalance there. Like, I've released a lot of music on other people's labels recently in the last 5 years, sort of in the, you know, when I restarted the label. But for me, so I was releasing a lot on other people's labels and just, again, enjoying that handshake, enjoying, hey, release a record with a label in Lisbon, because next time I'm in Lisbon, it's like we'll be able to do something. It's just like a handshake in a different way. So strategically, that's a good idea, but also too, just like more, you know, friend in every port kind of thing. And my label went on this big sort of spree of releasing other people's music, because I just, when it was time to restart the label, I did one EP by myself and did a couple of what do you call them, retrospective things for people that wanted some old stuff that were on those old polyplastic records,
yeah,
and sort of, I guess, satisfied those people. And it's like, we want it. Okay, cool. We'll do it. And I did a bit of that. And then it was just straight on to new music. And I went on a massive listening spree and sort of making friends and people that had reached out about the label that, you know, genuinely sounded like, as crazy it was to me, it made an impression upon them. And then they're making music and it's like, wow, this is good. Let's put it on the label, you know? And so, did a bunch of various artist EPs with, that was sort of like people from the four corners of the world, all mostly people that were like greenhorns on vinyl. So first time they've ever been on vinyl, which I just love, you know, speaking to those people and enjoying the joy that they get out of that, because I remember that. It's wicked. Yeah. Like, it's like, if you're not on, if you haven't released a record, not to say it's a requisite, but if you haven't released an EP or a record, maybe physical or digital, it doesn't matter. But it's just, when it happens, it's like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. And if it's on someone else's label, then it's like, wow, other people are involved and sort of have someone listened to my music and was like, you know, he or she might be listening to it in their car at the moment, or this business person had listened to my pokey music and they made a decision to press a record. You know, it's like that whole stuff is very cool. So, yeah. And some of these people, like a couple of, one gent in, who's from South Africa, you know, he's doing the sort of the pay it forward thing then with his gang there, in that, every time he emails me, you know, speak to him. We talk about running, you know, a DIY label. And it's like, well, cool. I want to give you all this information so that you can do the same thing that I've done for you kind of thing. Like, yeah, like legit. So that was what the label's been about for the last few years. But, then COVID happened. And it nearly sort of bankrupted the label a little bit.
Oh, wow.
And now I've come out and I've gone, oh, I better do some EPs myself on the label.
Right.
Just, you know, why not?
How did it nearly bankrupt you? Was it just because people couldn't tour, so they weren't selling?
This will apply to everything, but speaking of just the, you know, this pokey label's experience, it just put a stop on everything. So it's like I had, you know, maybe, let's say when you're on a full roll and you're releasing maybe like 5 records a year, maybe one's a compilation, one's maybe a double album or a, you know, that, you know, a bit of a mix of stuff. It's like they're all in different stages, right? And so, yeah, you cut it off anywhere. And in the end, it's just like, yeah, I've got a whole bunch of stock there. Multiple things happen. Yeah. The main thing obviously is that people stopped buying records a little bit. But of course, when everyone was stuck at home and looking for things to do and looking for things to spend money, then that got a bit of a bump because, you know, the home shopping thing got a bit of a bump with the records, but offset by the fact that, you know, no one could go out. No one, DJs were like, I can't afford to buy records right now because I can't play them to people and earn my wage. So all of that stuff. I think it was a net loss, you know, but the last release was a hugely ambitious project for a guy who I completely love to bits, a German fellow who was on the very first compilation I did in 2000. And it was like, I know I've got your demo tape still. And he was like, oh my God. And I'm like, have you released any of this stuff? And he's like, no. And I'm like, this stuff is great. Let's do it. And so we just got this original demo tape that I pulled CD that I pulled, this one track off for the compilation in 2000. We did a full double pack, you know, with beautiful photos by my friend Patrick of Berlin when he was there, and, you know, just elaborate. It's like a double LP, you know, color sleeves, sort of, you know, download vouchers. And we got a remix done by David Mufang, aka Move D, who's a huge figure in dance music, who happens to be a personal friend of this guy. So it was like, you know, paying for the remix, which is all good, just all these things sort of pile up, and it's like, whoa, I guess it's like some big movie budget where you're like, we probably actually need to sell 500 of these just to make even, you know. But, you know, screw it. But yeah, it's the stop of the flow of all these things. And then, for the first time ever, I had to crush some records. So basically at some point sort of during the last 2 years, one of my distributors, who was fantastic and a very big one in the UK, was like, we just can't deal with. There was a particular couple of releases that didn't go too strong, but they would have got there, you know, given some time. But they're like, we need to make space. This is sort of like,
oh, really?
And it's not, that's not an uncommon thing, but it's just like, okay, so you own these records, like you paid for them to be pressed, but they're in a distributor warehouse, and they're like, well, they're not selling. And this is taking up space for something that could sell, something newer or whatever the case may be. You know, we want to send these back to you, obviously at my charge. And then all of a sudden the postage costs, you know, went up even more. And you've got this whole pile of wax in London that they want to send to you in, I'm going to say in this context, little old Perth. It's not that anymore, but like, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, so you want to send me 200 records that I don't know what I'm going to do with here.
Yeah, you know? It's going to cost a fortune to get them.
Yeah. So it's like, and I felt that was like a real big boy decision, because I was like, oh, wow. Like I've just figured it all out here. Take the emotions aside. That's what I mean by big boy. It's like you have to crush this music because it's actually cheaper and better, you know, and all the things. You don't want these things going I don't overthink this stuff too much, but you don't want your music sitting in bargain bins.
Yeah.
You know, secondhand stores, cool. Like 1 or 2, 3 copies, but you don't want, like, you know, when you go to an op shop and they've got like, I don't know, they've got all the usual kind of cool, like Nana Mouskouri and some like Oompa music. And then there's this one record where it's, for some reason, they've got like 20 copies of.
Yeah.
I think it dropped off there. You don't want to be that guy or gal.
And how did the international things come about? Like, how did these connections happen?
Yeah. Well, I would say there's 3 main things that happened that were all awesome and I learned lessons from. The first one was, I'm pretty sure I can mention his name. It's not like it's, but there's a guy called Brett Dancer who runs a really seminal record label in America called Track Mode Records. And just, you know, with all the artists that I idolize, that kind of stuff. And I sent him demos. And then one time, it's like there was one track, you know, long story short, it got onto a compilation of his right next to my idol, Larry Heard, on the record, which is just the weirdest thing that's still, I think, to this day, happened to me. Because that was the very first time I got a track, you know, licensed or whatever, or taken onto a label. Part of the sort of the, I guess the unpublished version of what happened there, which does look weird to some people. I think definitely the kid from Perth gets a sort of to join a gang like that who, you know, were mainly, I think, all American people that were already pretty huge, was that I was like, I want to, you know, I've got this label. I probably sent him the early records. And I was like, I've got this label and I want to release more, you know, other people's stuff and sort of do this. And he's like, all right, I'll help you, you know, or sort of be a sort of a pseudo agent. You know, this is very casual. A pseudo agent. I'll help you with a few key connections here in America. But it was like, you need to pay this forward. You need to put people on this record that, you know, that you can then, you know, do the repeat process. And so, yeah. So on that proviso, he was like, he helped me hook up distribution with a massive distributor in America. And the first order, and he sort of taught me, you know, a few trips on what to do. So I had this list of distributors. I was faxing them, calling them, sending them CDs, to say, I'm pressing this record. You know, this gent is sort of acting as my, I don't want to say agent, but sort of like,
mentor,
you know, he put me onto you, that kind of stuff, dropped the names. And I got a couple of distributors and it ended up that, you know, we pressed 1,000 of these records. And this is coming from 100 in Quarter in Melbourne to 1,000 of this thing. And this record featured an artist from Estonia, an artist that I mentioned before, Kai from Germany, myself, and a guy called Stephen Tang from Chicago. And, this guy, Brett Dancer, helped me to sort of connect all the dots in America. And America's just amazing. You get a couple of distributors on point and one of them says, cool, well, you know, I won't do the accent. I'll put one in every store and we'll see how you go. And you're like, cool, how much is that? And it's like 400. It's like, what? Like, that's how big the underground, it's always, you can't even call it like the underground sort of system was happening in America. This is like people that were distributing my record and distributing Janet Jackson remixes.
Yeah.
Right. So all of that in between, all of that, anything on vinyl, massive. And that all collapsed in the mid 2000s. So yeah, that was a huge one. And then just recently, I guess a much shorter story. But recently, I've got this distributor called Small Black Dots, some people that I trust with everything. If I had babies, I do trust them with a lot of money and just all my sort of hopes and dreams. And they give me so much feedback and stuff about everything, even sort of wider than the label, just my own personal music sort of journey. These guys are based in Spain. They were very young when they sort of approached, or I'm pretty sure they approached me. And I'm now sort of part of their family.
Right. You
know? And they're, as a distributor, they've grown quite a lot. They've got a record store now, a physical one in Spain. Yeah. So they've been hugely helpful. Just, I love them to bits. And then what did I do? I got too big for my boots at a certain point. And I said to them, you know what? I'm going to try another distributor for a bit. For a couple of releases. And so I went to another one in the UK, massive, does like R&S records, like does like big time kind of dance stuff. And I was like, this is going to be awesome. Like massive distribution sort of network. Instead of my friends at Small Black Dots where, you know, two guys, this is a place where they've got a guy that just packs boxes all day.
Yeah.
Also, you know, there was one guy whose job was to just send labels free stock out.
Yeah.
I was like, holy moly. But of course, I became, and I'm not going to say big fish, but I'm just going to say a large part of the family at Small Black Dots. I went to this massive distributor and I was like, you know, I was a small fish. I had my support. I had my A&R guy. We did one record. You know, it went really well. We saw, I think it was like 3,000 or 4,000 copies or something, like crazy. There's definitely some of those left. There's definitely about 500 of those left. I've got some of them that, that I kept. But then, you know, it sort of petered out a little bit for the next couple. I think it just sort of had a couple of releases that maybe didn't hit that same spot, whatever the case may be. Then I got a massive bill. It was one of these, realizations where they were all like, cool, more releases, let's do it, let's do it. Yep, you want to do this, you know, you want to get Keith Tenniswood to master this record? It's like, whoa, yeah, for sure. And like when you're selling records, there's such a classic story of like, I don't know, what is this like when you get a, you know, I don't know, a loan that you suddenly can't repay because there was a point where it's like, yeah, missed a couple of releases, you know, missed a couple of the targets. It's like, well, then the invoices start coming in and the stock starts piling up both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's sort of, I was like, oh my God. So yeah, I end up having to pay off I don't know what it was, $3,000-$5,000. I can't remember, but that was painful. And so, you know, they understood that I think that I didn't really have the whole, what do you call that? The sort of the upscaling thing to match them.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, I just missed the spot on some of the music. And it's got nothing to do with the music itself was hot. It's just maybe wrong, you know, wrong place, wrong sort of release. But, and so I crawled back to my friends and they took me back and, you know, it's probably probably the best thing they ever did was being cool for me leaving for a while because like I will never ever do that to them again. And I'm friends for life. You know? But yeah. It was an amazing experience just purely from that distributor side of things. I think I should have sort of come to the party with, I don't know, hiring a promo person or really, you know, there's one thing about having a big distributor, but you know, if you're not promoting the records, it's not their job.
Yeah.
Their job is to make sure it goes in people's hands. But if that person's not sticking their hand out for your record because they don't want it, then.
Yeah. That's your fault kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. So yeah. So that was a really, you know, there was pain there, but now I look back at it and I was like, that was a really good experience.
It's interesting, isn't it? How much of this whole music industry, because you can't. There's no training for all of this. Like, it's just screwing up and then being like, and it costs a lot and it hurts. And then being like, well, now I know. And whenever like younger people come to me and like, how do you do this? And it's like, well, you just got to make a heap of mistakes.
It's absolutely true. It is absolutely true. Like, I like to think there's really two, and maybe this is a broader universal thing, but there's two ways of doing things, right? It's just like getting stuck in and, you know, like you just, getting stuck in and getting dirty and sort of progressing, you know, whether if it's a fail, it's still a page in the book.
Yeah.
Whereas like if you sit back and, you know, sort of prepare and overthink and sort of it's got to be best or else it's not happening at all, then fine. But there's just going to be no pages in the journey. And importantly, I believe, no pages publicly that yeah. can be enjoyed, good or bad, you know. It's just like splay it all out. Who cares, you know. I like to think that that's one thing I attach to what people, inverted commas, call the underground, is the warts and all, I'm traveling, come on the travel kind of scenario. That's part of it. I know today, like, you know, big music stars and stuff, you are literally like seeing every single picture and
yeah, everything they do
1 minute and stuff. But it's like, I like to think that the underground kind of stuff is like that in music. It's like you can hear the progression and, you know, it's like the next record you realize that, you know, the guitarist just got a wah-wah pedal and you're like, you know, it's like that was the difference or, yeah. you know, and or the electronic version of that, you know, someone buys another keyboard and you're like, whoa, I can just hear what's happened and the music, but I can hear this person is like building. This is very cool.
Tell me about the global compilation imprint Deep Sounds.
Yeah. So that Deep Sounds was the compilation that this gent Brett Dancer assisted.
Oh, that was
me.
The one.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I should have named that. And so yeah. that is literally, it's meant to be actually a funny story about the first one that's worth mentioning because I just think it's hilarious. There was this guy, Steve Tang, on the record. And this is a testament to Perth, really, actually, too, the Perth Deep House scene fully, because Steve Tang put out this record called Windy City on, I think, his own label called Emphasis Records. And it was stocked, you know, well here in Perth, Ben Stinger Complex or Purveyor, I can never remember which one at what time it was named, you know, had that amazing record, you know, it was on radio, it was in clubs, it was just the most amazing thing ever. Whoever this Steve Tang guy was just, you know, a lord. This was great, this music. And I was like mailing, as I did, bought records from the store and, you know, faxing, calling, doing whatever, leaving messages on answering machines, whatever phone number or contact was on the records. And email yeah. was still like, it was about, I reckon, a third of records had email. And like, I just wanted to, I'm pretty sure I sent him demos. You know, and then we got talking and then at some point in time, it's like, okay, I've got this record, you know, happening with this guy. It's, you know, it's got this good support behind it. You know, I want you to be a part of it, sort of be the, you know, the big brother of the four, because the other two guys were like, just, you know, in the woods, kind of completely, newbie. And I considered myself just completely newbie too. But now when people look at that record, they think that I discovered him. And all it's right. like, no, you totally got it wrong. It's like, I was like, yeah, it's so, so weird. But yeah, that imprint is just like me saying, you know, how cool is it, you know, that you can get four people from four corners of the earth onto one record and just be a little happy family for a while and then do the like label business and chat and have fun and yeah. And, you know, and each teach each other some stuff about the sort of the label or what your own scene's doing and just, you know, I mean, it's cultural exchange.
Yeah.
You
sure.
know? Yeah.
Is that how you found the other two as well? Like just looking at labels and finding phone numbers and. So there's Steve Tang, yourself, and who were the other two people on the first?
Actually, seasons? Yeah, I'll probably pronounce this wrong. I don't think I've ever spoken to him, but Tanel Alame from Estonia and then Kai Kroker from Germany, who went under the name of Roel. Those two I met on a website called mp3.com,
right.
which was like a pre-Napster, you know, pre-iPod. Definitely MySpace. It was like a place where, yeah, music was posted up by the creators onto various sort of sections of the website. And there was a big like house music section. And people, if I ever meet, I think it's Derek May, who was the, what do you call it? Like the parent of the, or the supporter of that section. It was like, right. here's this, yeah, it's literally like, here's this famous person who's like a, you know, a progenitor of this music brand and they're involved in this side, or at least they put some of their own tracks on. So why don't you do it too? And so it was like a whole bunch of people that were producing and just a whole bunch of people in their bedroom all posted their music up. I mean, I guess I'm just describing what SoundCloud is here, but it was literally like one of the very first ones that happened. And it was a massive community. I ran a couple of like what they called radio stations on there, which I would just scour this thing, listen to it all day, all night, just finding awesome music. And then I'd, you know, add it to my radio station, which is called like the Deep House radio station or something on this website, you know, and I started getting a lot of listens and stuff. I used to, you know, chat to a lot of people then on email. And this radio station, of which before the site went down eventually, it basically got, what do you call it? Nuked by record labels and publishers because back then they were definitely still 100% against any.
Yeah, right. Digital, streaming or yeah.
Yeah. Digital problems. But, yeah, I luckily before the site, went down, I sort of downloaded all the tracks. So I've still got them all on CD. And I've, you know, I've put them up all on SoundCloud sort of, you know, for non-monetization purposes, just so it's sort of there for people. Some of the artists went on to go, you know, to record, records. Some of them were on Deep Sounds.
Yeah, cool.
You know, but some went on to other labels and other people I've not been able to contact or find. They've just made this music. It was on this site and then it went down and that's it. You know, and I honestly, I might be the only, there's probably 20 tracks on there that might be the only person that's got them on CD still.
Yeah, right.
Like, so weird. Yeah, so that was like a really early online music sort of community. And it was pay for play. So every time a track that you posted a track on this website, every time you played it, there was literally like a one, like some sort of one-to-one metric where it was like, I don't know, whatever it was, 1 cent, right? For example, I literally got mail checks from mp3.com, you know, head office, New York or whatever, like, you know, those cool American checks. I only got a few of them, but I got a few. Yeah. For like, you know, $10 or $20 or whatever.
Yeah, right.
It was crazy. People gamed that, of course, by just leaving the play button on in their office all day or whatever. But, yeah, it was crazy. It's great. When I tell people, it's like, it's crazy that that existed. And it's like, yeah, that's the power of big business, I guess, that doesn't like something going on, that we literally had, which is what everyone wants right now, is just a decent pay for play website where you can put your music on and you get paid when someone listens to it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know it's the others, there's plenty doing that now, but it's a little bit different.
So, Red Ember Records, celebrating 25 years.
Are we?
Is that right?
Am I? No, it's probably going to be, I mean, it's close to that. It's probably more going to be like, no, I think you're right. 97, 22, yeah, gosh, okay.
25 years.
Yeah, that, I did not know that.
I didn't either. Danny did, though. Producers are great.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Were you going to ask me if I've got a special...
yeah. What are you going to do? Celebrate 25 years.
Or a gig. Clearly nothing. gosh. Okay. As it turns out, I'm arrogantly doing a couple of records that is just me. So, there you go. That's, as it turns out, what I'm doing, literally. Yeah, that's funny. I got to admit that. Just, I mean, I honestly, that is the first time I thought about that. It's a good round number, isn't it? Or an auspicious number, 25. Yeah, the sort of, I've been hell bent on sort of cutting forward from the old days of the label, you know, like I did, as I mentioned before, did do a few, you know, retrospective reissue kind of things. I've just recently done a massive dump. A careful but massive dump that's not finished yet of like all my old tracks and demos and stuff, like hundreds and hundreds of it that I made and that are all on DAT tapes and CDs. I put them on Bandcamp.
Right.
Right. I'm just, because like I want to throw those tapes out now. It's just like, that's it. There's no more, you know, no more looking back. That's what, yeah. I mean. I don't consider myself, I don't want to, this sort of bag, you know, this bags in other people, but I don't consider myself or really much, in the sort of the old Red Ember days that sort of, you know, is like a big hit or anything like that. It's just like, you know, there was a thing and it was cool and, you know, yeah, definitely there's a few people that was like, well, I didn't have access to that because you're pressing 20 records and I'm telling you I like it. And it's like, cool. Well, I trust, you know, I'm not going to argue with you. So like, let's re-release some stuff. But it's like, you don't want to, I don't want to be doing that.
You want to move forward.
Anymore. Yeah. Plus just with the label stuff, again, you know, if you've got like, I don't know, whatever it is, $3,000 or $4,000 that you sort of put together to pay for a pressing or maybe not even that, half of that for like a small pressing. Do you want to be pressing a remastered version of something you made when you were 20? Or do you want to make something that you're like you just made yesterday that you're like super amped about?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying I hate my old stuff or anything, but some of it I'm just like, man, that's a bit whack. You know, but it's like, I'm not. With music, it's, you can't, just if I make something and you put it out there, I really believe it's just like, I mean, you know, copyright purposes, it is mine, but it's just not yours anymore.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, yeah, it's like, okay, you own it, but it's like, it's just when you put it out on record or whatever, someone buys it, there's a spiritual like, okay, you know, it's yours now. Like, whatever you do with it or how you feel about it or what makes you feel or think about, then amazing, because I'm done with it. I had the, you know, that's, I had that period, and then it's like it got spat out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love following artists through that journey, and I want to see what they're doing next, and I want them to be wanting to push forward when they start to get nostalgic or long for their old days. You kind of like, it's probably where you jump off often.
It's totally. I was talking to someone the other day about there's that period with, there's that stage with companies where, you know, that make brands that we may all use and follow, where they stagnate and they're not doing magical things anymore. And what do? They look back. No, actually, they look down at their customer base, their fans, and they're like, let's gouge them. You know, it's like they're always wanting to, for them, it's like, I want to make more money. And it's like, oh, let's gouge our existing base, you know, as much as possible, instead of spreading more magic, making more like, maybe you can't sort of, you know, travel some more yards, find new things or, and I've done a little bit of that. Cool. That definitely. And I really feel like I was like coaxed into it, or I just, it was like, people are asking, so you do it. Sort of like, you know, there's sort of an action and reaction thing. But like, who doesn't want to just keep on making, you know, some people get tired or run out of inspiration, but who doesn't want to keep on at least trying to just make new music? That risk of putting it out into the world is addictive.
Yeah.
You know, to get the reaction or whatever, good or bad. It's like, wow, cool. Well, you know, that's that. And it makes me think a lot. Like, I sort of, going back to the remaster thing, I think there's probably very few little bands and stuff, people in the world that I have like the remastered versions of the album. And I sort of, you know, get sucked into the, into that zone. One is Yellow Magic Orchestra, definitely. Ryuichi Sakamoto, who's a real hard one because he just has so many releases. But I often think, why doesn't Ryuichi Sakamoto just make an album like crunchy synthesizers and like, just like his first couple of records? Why doesn't he go back and do that? It's like, people want it, you know, and he's making this sort of ambient sort of stuff that's co-written with someone who's like on a guitar or whatever. And it's like, we want synth, man. Like, and it's like, he's moved on. I don't know. Maybe he will do that now to spite that comment. And I hope he does. But, you know, like, I just respect the fact. It's like, well, okay, I'm not going on the journey with you, but I respect the fact that you don't want to, perhaps you don't want to travel old ground.
You know,
make me, your fan, an album that sounds, that's like some sort of AI version of your first album, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And can you even go back in time and capture that same thing, right? Like,
and there's a risk, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like, I can't think of any examples, but I reckon there's been heaps of examples of, this just makes me think of bands, but like, that have gone, you know, they're at album 7 or something, and it's like, the 8th album sounds like the first one, and it's like, whoa, where did that come from? Like, and it's really good,
yeah.
You know? I don't know. And then sometimes it's just a fail, or, you know, people that do the symphonic albums, like, ugh.
Yeah, the greatest hits start coming out.
Oh, yeah, those. The contractual obligation albums.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ewan, I won't keep you too much longer. Before you leave, where do you see Red Ember in, like, 10 years?
Wow. I honestly still think that it will just be me and some people I've come across, you know, releasing on the label. I think, when it comes to like being a musician or someone that makes music and running a label, when you just sort of put those two things in front of me on how I'd like to say spend tonight, I running a label is sort of is the second thing. It's a means to an end. Whereas, yep, I know there's people out there who don't or can't make music, that like being involved in, you know, doing that instead of being an accountant. I know that's a mean example. Is like, wow, I'm in the music industry, and it's like, awesome, you know, great, you know. But I'd rather be making the music. So it's sort of the choice between two things that are both fun, But yeah, I think that I'll probably just be calling up my friend Andrew, who makes the drawing for the next record. You know, calling up the guy that does my design, ringing up my distributor, saying, "Got another one," and then and then that's it. It just gets sent out to a few shops, and then we move on. You know, so I think I'm happy to just stick on the DIY low level. I think.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
A big thank you to Ewan Jensen for joining us on First Pressing. First Pressing is an RTRFM podcast championing the local visionaries behind WA record labels and the incredible communities they nurture. Our producer is Danielle Raphael, with production consultation by Matthew Parrott. Our artwork is by Lyndon Blue. Music is by Michael Strong. My name is Mark Neal, and I'm your host. This podcast was recorded and produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. We pay our respects to elders past and present. This land was never ceded. Next time on First Pressing, we're joined by Ryan Borrett of Rockton Records. Founded during the height of the pandemic, Rockton Records shines a light on projects that often sit on the fringe of the spotlight. I'll catch you then.